Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1 with It's for Women. The car insurance with extra benefits like personal accident cover.
Well, Charlie Haughey was, depending on who you ask, either the great villain of Irish political life or one of the most talented politicians of our time. Saint or sinner, he continues to divide opinion to this day. Now, however, having been given exclusive access to Haughey's personal archives, Professor Gary Murphy from DCU's School of Law and Politics puts his life and legacy under a microscope in a new biography entitled Haughey. And Gary joins me now here in studio. Morning, Gary. I have to say, I thought I knew a lot about him. It's a fascinating book.
Thanks so much.
And as Matt Cooper says in his review in the Business Post today, it's also brilliantly written. Listen, so much has been said about this man, so many books, countless articles and programmes, but you have broken new ground here with access to his private papers. Tell me about that and just how extensive an archive you gained access to.
Yeah, thanks, Miriam. His archive is extraordinary and extensive in equal measure. From a relatively young age, when he was trying to break into public life, how he started keeping his papers. So he'd keep letters he sent or letters he received from various figures, some of which I charted in the book, and he started keeping documents. And in 2010, the Haughey family donated his archive to DCU, to our library there. And over the course of the past decade, the university has built a purpose-built archive, and where we now house the papers. They're in 254 boxes, big blue boxes, and then there are five or six perhaps sub boxes in many of these. Other boxes. So there's lots. And it covers literally all his life, from the time he entered public office to basically his death. And the family have archived things like newspapers from the time of his funeral and whatnot. And they're extraordinary. And as I point out in the book, they cover everything from correspondence with the great and the good, Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Kohl, François Mitterrand, and others. There's a lot of material around his sort of life in Fianna Fáil. There's lots of good stuff, I think, on the sort of the leadership battles in 79. But there are also extraordinary amount of letters to ordinary people and from ordinary people. And I mean, like Mrs. Murphy, Mrs. O'Callaghan from Donny Kearney, who has no indoor toilet, 10 children, perhaps a deserted wife, writing to him seeking help. And they're amazing, really. They give one, I think, a snapshot into what it was like to be a public figure. But they also give a snapshot, I think, of Ireland and how Ireland developed over the course of the five or six decades that Haughey was a public figure.
Let's go right back. I found all the childhood stuff about Charlie Haughey, his dad, his mum, fascinating. Go right back. Remind people about his father and his mother.
Yeah, they were from Swatra in South Derry. I spent a day up there back in 2018, I think, in the company of his cousin, Seamus MacWilliams. And people would know Monica MacWilliams from the peace process, who is also a cousin and who helped me with the early part of his life. So his parents were strong Republicans. His father fought in the War of Independence. They hid out Johnny Haughey hid out in a trench. I saw the sort of the remnants of that trench in Swatra. And Haughey's mother, Sarah MacWilliams, she brought food. She brought blankets to the men who were in the trench. And so his republicanism quite clearly comes from his parents. Now, his father was invalided out of the army in 1928. After the War of Independence and the Civil War, he joined the then Irish Army. And he was sick. He basically had multiple, what we would now call multiple sclerosis. His wife, his mother Sarah, had a long and difficult battle with the authorities to ensure that she had got a pension. After he left the army in 1928, the Haugheys moved around. They were in the Regans in Dunshaughlin. They spent a little time in Sutton. They spent some time in Limerick, and eventually they settled in the early 1930s in the working class estate of Belton Park in Donnycarney on the north side of the city. where she lived until she died in 1989. His father died when Haughey was relatively young. He had just entered UCD when his father died at the relatively young age of 49. And certainly his father's illness, I think, had a serious effect on him. For instance, Haughey's brother Owen Haughey, Father Owen Haughey, who was an Oblet father, a person I interviewed back in 2014 when I began that this research. I went down to the to Inchicore and we had a grand chat over.
He's a lovely man, actually.
Yeah, lovely man, nice cup of coffee. But he never saw his father walk, for instance. Sarah McWilliams, or Sarah Haughey, used to lift Johnny Haughey up and down the steep stairs. And for those of us who lived in sort of two up, two down houses, corporation houses like I did in Cork City, you know, they were steep stairs. And he, so this, I think, had a major impact on the young Haughey. He was very keen. He was very good at school, as we know. He went to Joey's, but in the primary school in Merino first, he was very keen to enter the workforce, and it was his mother, Sarah, who persuaded him that no, he had to go to secondary school and should go on to university. He came first in the Dublin scholarship exam in 1938, first of 500. There's a photograph in the book. It's from the Irish Press in August of 1938, and it's Cathal Haughey. He was known as Cathal. He was born Charles James, as sort of everybody would know, but he was called Cathal throughout his childhood. He was Cathal in the house. He was Cathal to his brothers and sisters and his parents. And he doesn't really become the Charlie we know until he goes to UCD. He had thought about entering the army, and he was in what we know as the FCA during the war, during the emergency. But his mum was a very significant sort of force in him going on to university. And the reason he was able to go to university in UCD in Earlsford Terrace was because, again, he got a Dublin Corporation scholarship to go there. So, I mean, I don't want to overplay it a moment, but he certainly was brought up in what we would consider pretty straitened circumstances. Having said that, his mother was able to provide. She had a little vegetable patch, and you'd see her wandering up and down the roads of North Dublin, selling her wares. But you know, they played football. They had football boots. I mean, they had their uniforms for school, and she did an amazing job. And most of them went on to become very successful. Mm. His brother Sean was the assistant city manager in Dublin Corporation. His brother Jock, of course, was a rather controversial figure during the arms crisis. They were a very sporting family. Jock Haughey played and won an All-Ireland football medal for Dublin in the 1950s, where they beat Derry in 1955, and a cousin of Haughey's was playing for Derry. So a very varied and sort of, I think, exciting childhood, probably.
And the book has loads of gorgeous and different anecdotes in it as well. Tell me about the incident, Gary, on a train from Derry when he was just a child. Tell me about that.
Yeah, he and his brother Sean were on a train. So what happened in the summertime is that his mother would send the boys to Derry for a break. To be perfectly frank, she had a very difficult time with her husband. So they would be sent on the train, and they would be collected by Patsy McWilliams, Monica McWilliams's father, and they would do some sort of manual labour on the sort of farm, and they would go to dances, and they would play football, and they would, they became part of the sort of South Derry community. But they were taken off a train on the way back when they were 14 and 13, Sean and Cathal, by the B Specials, and basically were questioned, I suppose, for the want of a better word. They had their new coats taken off them, and then they were put back on the train. So, it's a small anecdote, but it certainly gives a kind of a flavour of the difficulties, I think, Catholic youths had in Northern Ireland at the time, and it also gives a flavour, I think, of the emerging republicanism that in many ways dominated hockey. When I get to the sort of politics of it, I do try to I think through the sort of republicanism, the nationalism, and I do think that is probably again shaped by some of his formative experiences. You know, if you're taken off a train in your early teens, these are the type of things that stick with you.
You write really strong as well about when he went to UCD and obviously that time when Gareth Fitzgerald was there as well. Remind us about those times.
Yeah, so how he went to UCD. There's a great photograph, I think, in the book of him with a suit, sort of replete with pens in his top left pocket. And again, very few people from Donnycarney would have went to UCD, which is, I think, the first point. The second point is that Haughey was there on a Dublin Corporation scholarship. He had thought about doing medicine, but he ended up doing commerce. He had been persuaded by Harry Boland, his great friend amongst others, that, you know, for one making their way in the Dublin of the 1940s, late 1940s and early 1950s, a commerce degree would be a good way into the economics of Dublin society. There's a lot sort of written in the past about Haughey having this terribly inferiority complex in UCD. He met his wife there, Maureen Lemass. They started courting, used that phrase, in the mid-1940s. She told me he had never had any inferiority complex, that he had loads of friends, boys, girls. Gareth Fitzgerald famously said in... I think it was in your documentary in 2005, Miriam, that, you know, how he was always with boys, I was always with girls, at quote Gareth. But she said he was, you know, he wasn't hung up about his class or his status. But I think some other people probably were. But it was a sort of a different world, I think, for Haughey, but one that he acclimatised very quickly. He became a leading member of the Commerce and Economic Society. He was a champion debater, as was his, as was Maureen Lemass. She wins the. There were debates for women competitors at the time. They met at the bike sheds in Earlsford Terrace, and they began what became obviously a very serious romance. They would later, of course, get married in 1951. Married in Ranelagh, and they had this extraordinary 60-year life together. Some of it made very complicated afterwards and difficult for both of them, but I think especially for Maureen Lemass when the Terry Keane affair became known, and the difficult later years when the tribunals were stalking Haughey, and when the public were baying for his imprisonment. My view is that she clearly loved him, and I think he clearly loved her. But he had, as I write in the book, I think he had numerous personas, public and private, and. Unlike many people, he was certainly able to compartmentalise them. UCD was very important to him, very important, in shaping him. He met people from all sorts of classes. He didn't just hang around with people from his own, who were his secondary school friends. He was great friends, obviously, with Harry Boland, and they set up Haughey Boland, the accountancy firm, and that then brought him into the sort of the moneyed circles in the sort of mid-1950s, and that's also the time, of course, where he starts thinking about entering public life.
And his rise wasn't meteoric, sure it wasn't, Gary. I mean, as you point out, it was actually quite a slow political rise, running a number of times before he got a seat in the Dáil.
Yeah, very much so. The history of modern Ireland might be much different if Haughey didn't win in 1957. He was elected for the first time in 1957. But at that stage, he had two general election defeats and a by-election defeat in 1955 to Alfie Byrne's son, the famous Lord Mayor of Dublin. So it's not an instant successful political career. He was attracted to Fianna Fáil, although his father was basically a Michael Collins man. And there had then been jibes, or there were jibes in Fianna Fáil, that Haughey really wasn't one of them. There's the famous phrase about Margaret Thatcher, you know, from Hugo Young's biography, one of us. But there were certain people in Fianna Fáil, who didn't like hockey, who didn't particularly like him in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and found him somewhat gauche. You know, the famous Man in the Mohair suit, although hockey always said he never wore a Mohair suit, that he had more class than that. So I think the sort of the outsider motif, that again is in your brilliant documentary from 2005, is true and is a correct interpretation. But yeah, the voters certainly didn't love him. But from once he was elected in 1957, he topped the poll every single time until his final run, which was in 1989. He retires at the November 1992 election after leaving office in February of that year.
Remind us about the Three Musketeers and, I suppose, the reforms during the 1960s.
Yeah, so Brian Lenihan and Don O'Malley and Hockey were sort of three of the coming men of Fianna Fáil in the again in the late 1950s, early 1960s. All very talented, all with tremendous amounts of energy, all with tremendous amounts of ideas, I think. I mean, for hockey, Fianna Fáil was the sort of the vehicle that was able to chart the nation's progress better than Fine Gael, to put it mildly or bluntly. He saw Fianna Fáil as a vehicle for social, economic and cultural progress. It was a sort of a natural fit for him. He was friendly with George Colley, although they had a great enmity later on. Of course, they were also classmates in Joey's. But Lenihan and O'Malley and Haughey. So Haughey is Minister for Justice in the early 1960s. He's replaced by Brian Lenihan when he goes to agriculture. Don O'Malley famously is Minister for Education. And I suppose to use a sort of modern parlance, they worked hard and they played hard. And there are all sorts of stories, some of them which I recount in the book and others which I don't, about uproarious, one might say, socialising. They socialised in the Gresham Hotel. They would have socialised in Groom's. They would have been there very late. Haughey had a young family at the time. I think it's fair to say that changing nappies and the like wasn't his forte. And he certainly he had publicists from as early as 1961. He was very conscious of public relations. He had decided from a very early age, when he started contesting elections, that, you know, he wanted to be in public life. I write later on, when the Terry Keane revelations came out, that, you know, he was thinking of going to France with her in the early 1980s. And I think, although there are some claims from Terry Keane that are true, I'm not convinced about that one, because I think politics was his life. And then he started mingling with politicians, and Lenihan, O'Malley and himself were well known on the social scene of Dublin in the 1960s. I do write, I think, somewhat humorously, of him being having great umbrage when he goes to the Gresham Hotel, and he's asked at the door for his name, and he says Haughey, and the usher says, "Are you Jock Haughey, the footballer?" So he took took great umbrage at that, but he are in good spirits. But yeah, certainly socialising was a big part of, I suppose, of Haughey's early and middle adulthood.
Stay with me. I'm here this morning with Professor Gary Murphy, who's talking about his new wonderful book on Haughey. We're just going to take a break. Join us in a few moments.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning with Professor Gary Murphy, and we're talking about his major new biography of Charlie Haughey. Look, I don't want to get bogged down in the arms trial. So much has been said and written about it, but it did dominate his life a lot. From your work on this book, Gary, do you believe he attempted to import arms into this country, and did Jack Lynch allow him become his fall guy?
Well, he certainly didn't attempt to import arms illegally into the country. And there's the great debate about whether Haughey knew that this the shipment coming in from Austria, organised by Captain Kelly, contained arms or not. Haughey was, of course, the arms crisis and the arms trial did dominate the second part of his life. And what I tried to point out in the book is, you know, if he had been found guilty, he was going to go to jail for, you know, anything up to 10 years, which depends on the sort of leniency of the judge. Now, he was acquitted, and there are riotous scenes in the Four Courts bar afterwards, and he calls for Jack Lynch to resign. I mean, there's been very good scholarship in the last couple of years. Michael Heaney's book, many people would know, which exonerates Haughey to all intents and purposes. The papers in DCU, and when we opened them in early in the new year, we'd be opening them sort of in trenches and some online. They're mostly to do with his strategy of his trial, documents to and from his lawyers. There are no smoking gun letters to say whether he. He knew what was in those cargoes or not. What I would say, though, is that it had a tremendous sort of impact on him and on his life. I write the ghost of the arms trial never really left him, and they didn't. Many people were convinced he was guilty and that the jury had made a mistake. I write at some stage about how he... It was John Healy, the famous backbencher, said he would always put his trust in 12 good Dublin men. And that's what Haughey, of course, did. His own evidence to the arms trial is short and it's clipped. The answers he gives are very precise. And he certainly built up a sort of his own sort of theory of what he knew and what he didn't know. And I tried to document in the book in relative detail, but it's a book about Haughey, not a book about the arms, and I spent two full chapters on it, how he considered it. But it did have an impact on him, obviously, when he was acquitted and called for Lynch to go. That clearly didn't happen. The cabinet rallied around Lynch. And how he spent a number of years in the wilderness before he was brought back into the shadow cabinet by Jack Lynch in 1975. What I again would say is that he certainly, this is Haughey, was of the view that Jack Lynch had basically done him wrong during the whole affair. It's interesting that Haughey again is the only parliamentarian who is put on trial. Neil Blaney, as we know, is acquitted earlier. Not acquitted, but doesn't even stand trial. And again, he was very embittered about his treatment. He, of course, left Fianna Fáil. I mean, Haughey had to vote confidence in Jim Gibbons. He didn't have to, but he did. He was very conscious of the fact that leaving Fianna Fáil and setting up a new party was not going to work. He might have had a very early success, but there was no long-term future in it. Now, there are complex reasons for the great success of Fianna Fáil up to 2011, but Haughey was wise enough to know that if he wanted a future in politics, he had to be in Fianna Fáil.
The first day, the day he became Taoiseach for the first time, you say in the book, Gary, you know, the opposition speeches, many of us are aware of them, but that greeted his nomination, they remain still some of the most aggressive scene in Dáil Éireann since its foundation.
They do, and it was an extraordinary day. Owen Haughey told me that he and his mum, Haughey's mum, were sitting in the VIP section and were clearly taken aback. Now, Haughey had warned him that, you know, this wasn't going to be very nice, and this was the sort of nature of the beast, so to speak. And the flawed pedigree of Garrett Fitzgerald's famous comment, and again, I think this is a comment that sort of haunted Fitzgerald himself for a number of years. And they were bitter enemies in the 1980s, but they became relatively friendly, might be too strong a word, but they had a friendly correspondence at some stage later on when they were both in their retirement. So Garrett Fitzgerald accuses Haughey of having a flawed pedigree. He blamed it on the lateness of the hour, that he drafted a speech the night before, and that it was Haughey's pedigree in Fianna Fáil, as I think from any social pedigree. Mm. But again, as I write in the book, from the Haughey's perspective, including Charlie Haughey himself, it did reek of a sort of social snobbery. I think Bertie Ahern, in his review of my book today, quotes a letter Haughey received from Joyce Andrews, the wife of Todd Andrews, one of the founders of Fianna Fáil, who complains of the genteel dastards in Fox Rock who believe that they should be running the country, not some working class upstart from Donnycarney.
Interesting. Now, The thing about Haughey, of course, is so much, I suppose, is written about the money he took from wealthy people, all the tribunals, the money that he had set up a scheme to get money for his friend Brian Lenehan's liver operation in the US. I mean, there's the Sean Doherty allegations. There's so much there. Yeah. Sticking with the money, all the money he got. I mean, at the end of the day, he was beholden to those people. Even if people say they could never show he did favours for them.
Yeah.
He was beholden to all of these people.
Well, that's the charge levelled at him. And you know, I mentioned Bertie Hearn's positive review. Mm. I mean, some of the reviews yesterday by Colm Tobin and Alan Chatter in the Irish Times and Irish Independent talk about the fact that maybe I don't ask enough hard questions about the money. But I tried, as many others have, to follow the money trail and it sort of like dissipates. Haughey's view, again, as I write, was that in the 1960s, he had handed everything over to Des Traynor. He was devoting himself to public life. And that trainer was to run his affairs. Now, we do know in the 1970s, 1976, I think, that Haughey had a very aggressive meeting with AIB, and he told him that he could be a very dangerous opponent. This is when they were threatening to take his checkbook off him. And of course, you know, in the era now of sort of revolution, tapping and whatever, it might be well to reminisce that, you know, the Ireland Haughey moved in the 1960s and 70s was an Ireland based on your checkbook, if you were him. So he would give a person a check. And he would expect it to be cashed, even though as he, when he became Taoiseach in December 1979, he owed AIB over £1 million pounds, Irish punts as it was. Then he famously and wittily but accurately told one of his questioners not to assume that he was a wealthy man. The Brian Lenehan thing is very interesting because he was very upset at the tribunal, the Moriarty tribunal, when he was questioned on it. He said that Brian Lenehan was his closest friend in public life for over 40 years, that everything he did for him, he did in good faith and in good conscience in regards raising the money. The money wouldn't have been raised if he didn't seek out the private donors. But what we certainly do know is that more money was collected than was needed. Haughey defences that all these accounts were mingled up. And I write about both what the tribunal found in relation to Haughey and Haughey's family's defence, which they published on their website after. And they were very upset about the tribunal, their view. And I try to assess this in the book, is that yes, Mr. Haughey received anything up to 8 million that we know of, but that he did not seek or give public favours for the money he received. He certainly didn't think any of this would come out. Mm. And of course, it comes out because of a feud in the Dunn's family between Ben Dunn and his sister, Margaret Heffernan. Haughey, to be blunt about it, left himself wide open to allegations of corruption because he did receive large amounts of money. It was Brian McCracken in the first tribunal, the short but forensically detailed McCracken tribunal, which was published in 1997, before the then very long Moriarty tribunal, which lasts over 13 years, takes over. That he just simply left himself open by being, as you say, beholden. But his view very strongly right to the end, and it is a view of his family, is that he had never taken a corrupt decision. I think Matt Cooper writes about it in some of his work, though. Mm. The mere view of having received all this public money, or this private money, will leave any public figure open to allegations of corruption. And this is what, of course, happened to Haughey. And it ruined his final years. He spends his final years, he got cancer in 1994. He had retired in 92. And he had that over the course of the following 10 years. But that was once the sort of tribunal started investigating the intricacies of his finances, his whole life unravelled, and he spent the last few years as virtually a recluse in Abbeville itself.
a magnificent house, as the James Gandy design mentioned there, but itself the subject of some controversy when Haughey moved into it in 1969, when he was Minister for Finance, in terms of rezoning, and like there was Conor Cruz O'Brien was and others in the Dáil were very critical of it, and Haughey had to have the Attorney General, the same Attorney General who basically took the or put him on trial in the arms trial, issue a statement to acquit him to all intents and purposes. But Abbeville itself became the subject of some controversy during the tribunal investigations where the money came from, yeah.
You mentioned earlier about Maureen Lamass, Maureen Haughey, and that it was a real love affair, that they did fall in love, you know, based on your analysis and writing about it. Obviously, Terry Keane, even I noticed last weekend when your book came out, you know, the extracts people still tend to hone in on is his long relationship with Terry Keane. At the end of the day, how important was she in his life?
I think she was important, and I think it would be somewhat ridiculous to suggest that she wasn't. They certainly had it sort of ongoing, on and off going, perhaps might be a better way to put it, 27-year affair from 1972 to 1999, when famously she went on the Late Late Show with Gay Byrne in May of that year. And at the same time, Haughey and Maureen went for dinner in Malahide with their friend Arthur Gibney and his wife. Haughey hadn't told Maureen that the interview was happening, I think much to his discredit. She was an amazing woman. I met her in 2014 in the company of her son, Sean Haughey, in her house in Baskin Lane, just at the edge of Kinsealy, basically. And she was a very strong-willed woman. I think the idea that Haughey married her so that he could move up in Fianna Fáil circles to go back a half a century is nonsense. It denies her any agency, and she had tremendous agency herself. She had an independent life. He certainly didn't want the affair to come out public. And Alan Chatterer mentioned in his review yesterday that everybody knew about this affair. Well, everybody didn't know about the affair. There was all these sort of rumours, and not everybody read the Sunday Independent, and not everybody was willing to believe that, you know, Haughey of such a public figure would have an affair. But he certainly did, and Terry Keane was important. There was this serialisation of her, well, it didn't become a book in the Sunday Times. Then there was stuff in the Ireland on Sunday in 2006 after he had died, including a variety of pictures. So it's clear they did have a long and significant relationship. But the idea, I think, that Haughey was ever going to leave Maureen Haughey for Terry Keane, I don't give any credence to. And perhaps, as I write in the book, it was perhaps French in orientation, that it was permissible to stray, but leaving one's wife wasn't an option.
Gary, I could talk to you for another hour, but unfortunately I can't. Your book, Haughey, it's published by Gill Books. It's available to buy now. It's a superb read. And as I said, as Matt Cooper said earlier, it's just really well read.
Thank
really
you so much, Miriam.
And you want to say happy birthday to your mother?
Yeah, my mother is 81 tomorrow, but unfortunately she's sick in Cork University Hospital at the moment. So I just want to wish her the best and to thank the nurses and doctors for looking after her so well. And I know she's listening in. So
happy
thanks.
Birthday, Margaret Murphy.
Thank you, Miriam.
Yeah, look after yourself. We'll take a break.